Hi, welcome to the Neural Information Retrieval Podcast. This is Sergi Castella, your co-host from Zeta Alpha.
And I have with me my co-host, Andrew Yates, assistant professor at the University of Amsterdam, right?
Yep.
You mind saying a few words?
Yeah, so I recently joined the University of Amsterdam from the Max Planck Institute for Informatics. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of research related to neural methods for information retrieval. So like ranking methods, but trying to better match query and document text by better capturing some agreement between the text itself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you're pretty knowledgeable about the space of information retrieval. So I'm really happy that we can talk today. So so the idea for this is today we're going to talk about a specific paper, which is this one I have right here, which is called Shallow Pooling for Sparse Labels. We might try different stuff, but the idea is that this is a quite interesting paper to spark a conversation. We thought, right, it has like a lot of things where you can, talk a bit, go on a tangent. I think it's really interesting. I don't know. Before we dive in, do you have any words to say about it?
No, I mean, I think it's a really interesting paper that brings up a lot of interesting topics related to evaluation and what we're measuring.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the topic of evaluation is, I feel a pretty big one. Like in the whole machine learning or even, you could say science, you can get into the philosophical domain pretty quickly.
yeah, it could get quite complicated. We'll try to avoid it.
All right, so let's just jump into it. So maybe you can give us an overview of what this paper studies.
So the idea of this paper is they want to study how well shallow pooling is working in this data set called MS Marco. Shallow pooling and MS Marco, I should explain both of these. Mm-hmm. So MS Marco is like a document collection and queries with judgments. The queries are things like natural language questions, mm-hmm. and then the documents are passages in the passage collection that give some answer to those documents. And so what I mean by sparse labeled is they know that a passage is relevant to a query, but generally you don't know what passage is the most relevant to a query, and you also don't necessarily know what other passages are relevant to the query. Mm-hmm. So sparse here means the number of annotations is very sparse. We only have basically one annotation per query saying this passage gives me an answer, but it's not necessarily the best answer.
Yeah. And why is MS Marco a particularly interesting, in the information retrieval domain?
Yeah, so this is just a much larger data set than other data sets that have existed. So in terms of queries, this has thousands of queries. Normal evaluations are maybe 50, hundreds at the most. Mm-hmm. And they were able to create this at a large scale by basically repurposing some question answering annotations. So they were trying to find the answers to these questions. They had hired people essentially to point to the answers in passages from mm-hmm. what I follow.
Yeah.
And so they knew what the answers were, and then they tried to move backwards to create this data set for us. Given the correct answer, what passage did that answer come from? Well, now we can label the passage as relevant. Okay. So by following this, crowdsource process where they don't try to necessarily judge every document, they are able to have many shallow or sparse labels mm-hmm. rather than, a smaller number of queries, but, many documents judged for relevance per query.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So there's, I guess, this trade-off, do you want 50 queries with many, many judgments each? This mm-hmm. is kind of a more traditional way to do it. Or the MS Marco style, which is many queries. So you see a lot of variation in the query, mm-hmm. but you don't have a lot of information about what's relevant to that query.
Yeah.
It's very limited.
And so. is this something that changed recently? Because I'm assuming that the recent neural retrieval stuff is way more data hungry, right? So did this data set emerge as a consequence of the whole neural retrieval stuff, or was it like predecessing that?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure about what motivation they had, but it came out at the right time for this. So they were looking at this data set for question answering, I think around the time neural methods were becoming popular. Mm-hmm. And so people were submitting neural methods to the question answering version of the data set. Like, okay. So this is not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about the ranking, but this question answering data set. So I think as neural methods became more popular in other fields, maybe they looked at this and said, we can turn this into a ranking data set without much problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As far as the amount of data, I think it's unclear how to count data in the sense, do you want to count each judgment?
Yeah.
In which case, MS Marco is definitely better than other data sets, but the gap is smaller than if you were to count each query, right? So MS Marco, maybe you have There's, for example, in the development set, 7,000 queries. This is 7,000 judgments. Mm-hmm. In a more traditional data set, you maybe have 50 queries, but each of those queries might have 1,000, 2,000 judgments. So whether so as far as data hungry methods, it seems like cross encoders, so methods that can look at the query and document at the same time, do okay actually with a small number of queries.
Okay.
But it's these newer, more efficient dense retrieval methods that try to represent the query independently of representing the document mm-hmm. that really seem to benefit a lot from having more queries.
Okay.
Let's
wait a bit to get into everything because I do think that's very interesting. But to recap, to see if I got it right. So for annotating MS Marco, you have for any given query, annotators review like a pool of documents that are extracted. How exactly?
So I don't think they describe the extraction process in detail. Okay. I think this has to do with, it may be related to some system they mm-hmm. use internally. But yeah, they're shown these 10 passages as a set, and then they're mm-hmm. asked to mark the answer.
Okay, to mark one of them as the relevant
but,
or...
But not even the passage. The answer inside the passage is what they marked.
Oh, okay.
So they said, here's the answer to the question. They highlighted mm-hmm. the span of text.
Okay.
And then that passage is then later treated as relevant because the answer was found inside it.
And is it, you know, if there's any like inter-annotator agreement stuff going on, or do they just like every person gives out one relevance and that's, you know, assumed to be good?
I'm not aware of any inter-annotator agreement they computed, but from what I got, this is done using internal Microsoft setup. So it's not, I think it's not that they're submitting a job to Mechanical Turk. It's that they have trained annotators in-house.
Oh,
so I assume they're controlling, paying attention to this sort of thing. But I don't think they've reported details.
No, it's really interesting. Okay, so as I assume, this paper discusses some problems. Well, problems, I don't know what word you would use, but some like limitations or some sort of sanity checks, maybe. Maybe we can get into that. So, let's step back a bit. You mentioned this idea of re-ranking rankers and neural retrieval. Can you give maybe like a couple of minutes of like, people were doing 10 years ago with information retrieval, and what is happening nowadays, and what are the like main key concepts that you need to?
Yeah, so I'm going to focus on matching query and document text to start mm-hmm. with. There's a lot of other signals like PageRank, for example, many people have heard of that could go into a learning to rank algorithm. But I think what we're talking about today with this data is specifically looking at match between terms. So in this context, people were using statistical models, so things like BM25, query likelihood. Mm-hmm. Basically, at a high level, these are comparing TF-IDF. So TF is something like the importance of a term to a document. Really, it's just the count, but maybe this is a proxy for importance of the term in the document. Yeah. And then IDF is some measure of how discriminative the term is. So the is not very discriminative. It appears all over the place. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter if you match the Amsterdam, much better term to match. So these statistical methods were using, these sort of features, basically mm-hmm. combining TF-IDF in some way. With neural ranking, the, I guess, first family of methods that came along were these re-rankers. So a re-ranking method takes a set of documents as input, so a set of candidate documents for a query. So, mm-hmm. The query is something like when was Amsterdam settled, and then it tries to re-rank the top 100, maybe top 1,000 documents for that query that were retrieved from a faster method. So something like this BM25 statistical mm-hmm. method.
So I have a bit of an embarrassing question, which is, what does re-ranker stand for? Or re-ranking?
It just means ranking again. So you have this ranking over all documents in the collection from, say, BM25.
Okay.
And then you cut that ranking off at like the top 100. And then you re-rank these 100 documents. Okay. So you come up with a new ranking.
The reason I'm asking is because, then I had it right in my head, but during the past week, I was reading some of this stuff, and I realized that you could also think of, I thought maybe re-ranker actually means retrieve and rank. And it sort of also made sense in my head. So I was afraid that for 2 years or something, I was thinking about it wrong. But I'm happy to hear that indeed, like the ranking twice is original thought behind it.
It means something similar, I guess, right? Retrieve with a first stage algorithm and then rank with the second. Yeah, right. You could interpret it.
Because in fact, you're not really using the the ranking of the first stage, you're actually not using that in the second stage normally.
Yeah, that's a good point. So with learning to rank methods that try to combine different rankings, often they will consider a ranking or a score. But with these neural methods, it's just a set. So they don't consider the ranking or even the score generally of the documents that they're re-ranking.
Sorry, I cut your explanation.
So we got to re-ranking, and then the next methods after that are something like dense retrieval, I would say. So these try to represent queries and documents as dense vectors, often single dense vectors, but not necessarily. So, you know, you put the query into this model, and you get back something like a vector with 768 dimensions, say, that somehow represents the query. You do the same for the document. Now you have a vector for the document. This allows you to use approximate nearest neighbor search, meaning you take that query vector and you find the top, you know, say 1,000 approximate nearest neighbors of that query vector. So these will be approximately the top 1,000 most relevant documents, assuming these representations are good, of course. So this gets away from having to do re-ranking, assuming you have fast approximate nearest neighbor search, because you can create these document encodings offline, you know, before query time, and index them and then do the search quickly when the query comes. One other final direction I'll mention is learned sparse representations. So this is something like TF-IDF, so something like statistical methods, but rather than using, say, term frequency, maybe you have a deep learning model learn something to replace term frequency with. So like a soft salience, term frequency, or term importance, term salience, exactly. But this is a little in a different direction.
I never heard of that. Is that a very recent... development or
So it's becoming more popular. So I think the first paper was DeepCT maybe 2 years ago at this point. It's hard to tell, maybe three. And there have been a few follow-up papers. So a recent one, for example, is SPLADE, S-P-L-A-D-E, I think from Neighbor Labs. But they all have a similar flavor in that they're using sparse representation. So rather than a dense vector with a lot of non-zero elements, so, you know, 800 non-zero, you know, maybe a vocab size vector, but many of the elements are zero and few are non-zero.
So just to recap, make sure I understand. So the main difference in the two-step retrieval is that there's like some computation that you can do very fast, right? There's some like basically encoding a query and a passage at the same time is very expensive, right? Because you cannot know the query a user is going to trigger in advance, right? So you cannot pre-compute it, but you can pre-compute the representations for all of the documents, right? So you can do that dot product or that similarity search really fast, and then you get this sort of trade-off of doing expensive doing like a very fast computation first and then doing a more expensive computation secondly, right? Is that
Exactly. So the way things are moving is for first stage retrieval, maybe the sparse representations or maybe approximate nearest neighbor search with dense could be used. And then you may still have a re-ranking method on top of that just because the re-ranking methods tend to work better because they're taking both query and document as input. They have a bit more information.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's a good introduction. So let's get back into the MS Marco and what the experiments that they do in this in this paper. I think that one of the things that I like the most about this paper is that I feel it's really simple to actually understand what they do or what, right?
I think it's really well written. It's easy to follow. It's a good paper, I would say.
So, so what do they do? What is this concept of a ranker that's better than perfect?
Yeah, so how they motivate this is they're doing research with, you know, some ranking method. So here it's a re-ranker they're using. And what they find is looking at the top passages, sometimes when the top passage they retrieve is different from the passage that's marked relevant, they think that the top passage retrieved looks better. So they're trying to investigate this to figure out how often these MS Marco sparse relevance labels are incorrect in the sense that they don't find the best passage.
That's a good. I mean, let's remember that, like you said before, the MS Marco only find one passage that's relevant, and it's never assumed that it's the most relevant, right? It just assumed that that's a relevant.
Yeah, exactly. Passage. So they almost have this assumption that it is the most relevant. They don't make that assumption, to be clear.
Well,
they don't
when
say
when
this.
When you choose the metric you evaluate that against, it's like you implicitly are saying that is the most desired.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, the metric they use, mean reciprocal rank, essentially looks at the reciprocal of the rank of the one relevant document you know about. So the interpretation
can you give an example of like how you would you like let's say you have a ranking and you have the first document is irrelevant, the second one is relevant, and then from that everything is irrelevant. How would you calculate the MRR?
So it's just one over the rank. So here you said the second document is relevant, so it's 1/2 your MRR, okay. Or your reciprocal rank is 0.5, okay. And then your mean would be averaged across a few queries.
Okay. This is, and you truncate that at some point, or you just ideally it's like.
So on MS Marco, they typically truncate it at 10. So they report this MRR at 10 is how you would write it. And what that means is they're just cut off at 10. If the document was in position 11, you get a score of 0 because it was cut off at 10.
So basically maximum score in this case would be 1, right? If you rank the top, and then it's like 1/2, 1/3, 1/4, right?
Yeah, exactly. Down to 0.1 at the 10th position.
And this assuming that there's one relevant, which is the case for most MS Marco queries.
Yeah,
I think.
Almost all of them have only one document marked relevant. And this, you can see, I guess, how it's based on the assumption that this is the best answer because you're only looking at one answer. So you want that one answer to be ranked highly.
Yeah. It's not like you're only looking at the recall 10 or like just if it appears, it just like it is better the higher that thing is ranked.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were explaining the experiments in the paper.
So they observe this behavior and then they start wondering, you know, how often this happens.
The top is more relevant than the annotation.
Exactly. So if the annotation's not on top, how often is that document on top better than the annotated document or the document marked relevant? So they set up a crowdsourcing study, essentially, where they ask Mechanical Turkers to judge this using preference judgments, meaning they show them the query in both passages and they ask which passage has a better answer.
Okay.
So they have, you know, this judge relevant passage, that's one of them. And then the other passage is either the top passage returned by the method they're running or the second ranked passage.
Okay.
It's second ranked if the top passage already agrees with the judgments.
Yeah.
Because they want to compare something still.
Yeah.
So they set this up. And then I guess we can move to figure one where they have some results. Basically, what they find... they break this down in four ways. When the neural ranker and the judgments disagree whether the top passage is relevant, the judgments are correct about 30% of the time, and the neural ranker is correct about 43% of the time. Slightly
as
under.
Correct, meaning that some annotator is saying, I prefer this one.
Exactly. So when there's disagreement, the annotators side with the neural method. 43.
Yeah. Actually, do you know if there's any, like, annotator agreement stuff, or if it's just like one per...
Oh, that's...
I don't know if...
Actually, a good question.
This,
but... I didn't notice. I did notice, for example, that they randomized the order of passages, things like this make sense. They also included some traps to make sure people were performing the task. But I actually didn't notice if there was inter-annotator agreement. I'm actually not sure if they used multiple annotators per passage now that I think about it. I think it's possible it's just one, but I'm uncertain.
Okay. And this is on a, I don't know if you mentioned it before, this is on a, not on the full MS Marco, but on a subset of queries, right? That I think it was
five? This is the development set, about 7,000 queries, something like 6,890.
Okay.
Later, they're going to sample some of these for another analysis.
So this
but
is
here,
a full
it's all
development.
Of them. Yeah.
And the development, there's actually another thing that we didn't touch on before. I'm assuming that the MS Marco has like a training, development, and a test set. And I'm guessing that the training and the development are accessible, like are public.
Yep,
but
exactly.
The test is you cannot.
Yeah, the test is not revealed. If you submit your run to the organizers, they'll give you a score on the test set for it. But it's private. The judgment for the dev set and the train set are public. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're using here. People often use the dev set as they develop things.
Yeah, of course. And I think that you already mentioned that this is from Microsoft, and some of the things are a bit opaque in how they're done. But is your assumption that the let's say all of these sets are annotated by the same set of people, basically?
Yeah, I believe so. And part of the reason I think that, well, first they don't say otherwise, mm-hmm. but another part of the reason is because this history coming from the question answer data set, I think that they collected a lot of judgments for this data set and then they divided them for this ranking data set is what I got.
Yeah. So you can assume that, I don't know if this is correct, but like the data distribution on all three partitions of the data set come from the same data distribution, as in, it's the same set of annotators. There's no reason why there should be like a distribution shift, between the...
We don't know of any reason to think there should be a shift. Okay. I'll put it that way.
Okay. So getting back to these results, right? So like you just said, it seems like on these 7,000 development set on these annotators from mTARG, the ranked document by the re-ranker is preferred more often than the one that is annotated.
Yes.
So that seems like throw everything away. Like this is, I mean, well, what do you take from this?
So I guess I have a complicated take on this. I guess it's true that the judgments are sometimes wrong, but also I just wonder what exactly we're measuring and trying to measure. Like even if the judgments were always the perfect passage, we would be measuring a very specific type of relevance with very specific queries, very specific documents. It, still in this case, I would wonder how well it transfers to another data set. So we know that trained on MS Marco does work elsewhere, but in order to understand how much moving between data sets matter, I feel like we have a circular situation where you'd really have to understand whether all of these other factors matter. Like, does it matter that the questions are natural language, not keywords? Does it matter that they're all very focused questions where there seems to be an mm-hmm. easy answer because it was highlighted for question answering? Does it matter you have very short passages, web-style passages, all containing mm-hmm. something like pointing towards an answer? I don't know, but even if we had perfect judgments here, these would, I think, still be questions to ask about what we're evaluating.
Okay. So you're sort of saying like the problems with this kind of benchmarking go deeper than whether the relevance judgments are good or not, because there's, you know, like deeper, sort of things that are, like you said, like the diversity of queries and all of this kind of stuff. Like there's even if the relevance were perfect, this would still, let's say, it's still a question whether this measures, this is a good measure for an overall quality of a ranker?
I'm sure. Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure it measures something pretty well, but how does this measurement with this setting affect the measurement you would get, you know, changing some of these variables?
Yeah, because
right?
that's actually what most people, I mean, well, I can speak to that because we are here. We're building search, semantic search technology with re-rankers and all of this stuff. And what we're really interested is to have models that translate really well to new indexes, to new data that are robust and blah, blah, blah. So this benchmark doesn't really measure that, right? Because we're training and evaluating on a data set that is really close, right?
Yeah, I guess it measures it to the degree the data set you're transferring to is similar to this data set in the ways that matter to your models, right? Which is very convoluted. Who knows what those ways are, right?
So it does seem like we're opening more questions than we're answering. Which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. So what I would say is that if you're only considering MS Marco, right, this is the task you care about, then obviously this changes the conclusion somewhat, or it has potential at least to change the conclusion somewhat, I should say, because this could change how methods are ranked on MS Marco. And if you know you really do care about this MS Marco task specifically, then, you know, it doesn't make a terrible method perform good, but it might change, you know, which one of the top methods you're most interested in, you know, pursuing further, or, mm-hmm. you know, what sort of techniques maybe.
Yeah.
So I guess there's both questions, right? So to me, it doesn't change the external validity a lot. Maybe it does somewhat, but I still have all these other questions where I don't know how this data set relates to some other data set.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas just looking at the data set internally, I guess I would, or maybe there's reason to trust the top rankings, the very specific rankings a little bit less, given that we know things could move around. And I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. They actually do look later in the paper whether runs do move around.
We can get into that, and maybe later we have some time to, because I really want to go back to this idea of what you said, that like even if these were perfect, there's still problems. There's still like lines of questioning or there's still open questions about how you can measure better what you want to measure actually.
Yeah.
So maybe we can go back to that after we... I think that the next version of the paper sort of looks a bit at how, or maybe this is a bit like a proposal of how you would improve the judgment scores in this kind of benchmark, right?
Yeah, so they have a plan for improvement, or a suggestion, I guess, mm-hmm. which is essentially just keep track of the best answer rather than keeping the judgments, you know, as they were given to us. As more systems are submitted, keep repeating this sort of evaluation so you always can identify the actual best answer, which would make MRR more aligned with the task, right? Because you're measuring whether mm-hmm. you found this single best answer.
Yeah, but isn't this, so I'm guessing you could think of this as a sort of like human in the loop benchmark where you keep updating your relevance all the time. Doesn't this complicate the idea of comparing, you know, like older... like you suddenly have like some sort of versioning of a data set, right, that you cannot... I guess you have to always run the latest, the latest version of the data set on all of the models to compare apples to apples. And I guess that you could also do some human in the loop in the training set, otherwise they're gonna drift.
It's not easy. So I don't think this paper mentioned what, if anything, to do with the training set. Mm-hmm. This would be a lot additional work even, because it's much larger in terms of queries. It's not for free, right? If you were to do this sort of thing, it would be a lot of annotation effort to keep judging the new documents. And like you said, there's this kind of strange property that you have to keep rerunning the evaluations, and previous runs may shift around when you rerun them. I guess if you have a previous run with the correct answer at position one, it might be judged. Well, that's not true.
Actually, that's a good question. Like, what do they propose? Let's start with that, because I think we're getting a bit ahead.
It's a better question. So what they propose is essentially, whenever a run is submitted, taking the top document for each query from that run. Mm-hmm. If that top document has not already been judged, judging it in some sort of tournament structure.
As in comparison-wise, like this is better than this, not... Is it relevant or not?
Yeah, so they're always using preferent judgments here. And now I'm realizing I'm not sure how this tournament structure would be created in this case where we're updating the dev judgments. But basically, you want to keep comparing pairs of documents till you find the best one.
Okay.
So I think what they suggested was maintaining a one best document per query. Whenever you get a new document that has not been compared to that document, you do a comparison and see if it's better. If it is, now you have a new best judgment, which means all previous results on that query will change. Mm-hmm. Because now you're looking at the position of this new passage you found.
Okay. So you sort of would calculate mean reciprocal rank with only that document marked as relevant?
Yeah.
And the other one would sort of switch to a zero relevant
Exactly.
scheme?
Yeah, so you're like replacing the relevant documents. Okay. It's not that you're adding new relevant ones. It's that your judgment for the best document has changed, so you're replacing that.
This seems quite drastic.
It is. It also makes sense, I feel like, in some ways. But it is drastic in that you're making documents that were previously viewed as relevant, non-relevant. This is because of the setting, though, where if your goal is really to find the best document, mm-hmm. you know it's the best.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like this is a really satisfying answer whenever the passage is very clearly relevant to the query,
yes.
right? But if you have ever annotated documents in a retrieval setting, and we've done this a few times here, it's so stressing because those cases are very few, I feel, in the real world. When you annotate, like, it's often really, it's relevant. It's not like 100%, but of course it's relevant. And I mean, I'm guessing that, I don't know, do you have a sense of how many of these MS Marco queries are like perfect matches, like absolutely like not only relevant, but like it really answers a question versus it answers a question more or less, right? Like you lose all of this gradation when you do a binary kind of thing. And I don't know. What are your thoughts on these?
Well, so for the MS Marco sparse judgment, I don't think this was really taken into consideration, like we said earlier, because it's just whether the answer appears. So I don't, in theory, nothing else necessarily matters. I don't know if the annotators, you know, were paying more attention to passages that looked better because of the segmentation or something than not. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But really, they're only looking for the answer.
Yeah.
With graded judgments,
but the answer is still is. I mean, actually, maybe you should just look at the. But like, how does an answer look like? Do you have, for instance, an example on top of your head of a query on MS Marco and what would be considered an answer to that?
Yep. So, for example, what is some celebrity's net worth? I think it's something like Rebecca Mercantile is the one I have in mind. So I don't know the real answer, but, you know, 10 million, for example.
It's very
straightforward.
That's super straightforward.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I think a more interesting one is something like, did the prohibition increase crime? So, you know, in the United States, prohibition when alcohol wasn't allowed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there is an answer marked, but looking through the relevant information, there's not really an easy, succinct answer because it depends what kind of crime and things like this. Like maybe it increased murders, but decreased petty crime and overall crime, right?
Yeah.
There's all sorts of issues that start coming up.
I don't know. I just feel like it's just such a hard thing to really like to know what is an answer to something, you know, what is actually relevant. How do you actually define these things, or is it just like some sort of loose agreement that we all sort of agree, like, yes, yeah, sort of relevant?
Yeah.
Like,
especially when you deal with best answers. So, yeah, I mean, when you deal with best answers, I don't actually know how to choose the best in many circumstances, right? They could be really similar. The fact that they lean towards the rankers here rather than QRLs, maybe this could mean that there's was a large enough difference between the QRL and the real best answer that someone could easily see it.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it would be interesting to kind of compare and look at why these might not have been the best answers in some settings, but I haven't. I mean, you can imagine there's lots of things, right? So maybe the answer exists in every passage, but the way the answer is presented is more confusing in one passage than another because of, say, segmentation, because these are passages from longer documents. So maybe if you just glance at this text, it's your eyes aren't drawn to the answer in the same way they would be for another text because, you know, how it was segmented, where it's positioned, maybe the surrounding context is different, maybe not. But it's there's all sorts of small
sort of
things that can go into it, I feel
ramifications,
like.
Yeah, things get really ugly. Anyway, let's go back to... I mean, I really think it's really interesting, but I also feel like it's more confusing than elusive. No, I forgot the word. But
So what I will say is with the dense labels, so for example, there's the Trek Deep Learning Collection. Maybe this is a good time to point to that.
That's a great point.
With these collections that are judged more densely, so rather than they have few queries, many judgments per query. So for example, Trek Deep Learning, my understanding is they're taking queries from the eval set of MS Marco and then they're judging them in a dense way. So they have trained annotators essentially for each query looking through a large number of pooled documents essentially. And here they used graded relevance, meaning rather than zero or one, there's some score. So for example, if they say three or four by these Trek Deep Learning guidelines, this means it's a very good result.
Okay.
I think four... the definition is something like worthy of being surfaced in a web search engine, right?
Okay.
So it should be the top. So this isn't preference.
So you have like four levels of relevance?
I think zero to four is what they use.
Zero
used.
To four, like not relevant at all, a little bit highly relevant and perfect match or something.
Yeah, it may
like
actually
that?
Be zero to three, I'm thinking. Like not relevant, maybe on topic, slightly related and highly relevant, something like that.
Okay.
They have slightly different guidelines also for document and passage ranking, so I'm mixing this
and
up
this
a bit.
And this is only used in benchmark, evaluation, sorry.
Yeah, so this is the more common way of, I guess, doing these evaluations. You have...
No.
You identify some documents likely to be relevant, maybe because they're returned by a lot of systems. Right, you're doing some pooling of the top results by different systems.
Yeah.
This gives you documents to judge, and then this.
And how hard? Like, why? This might be a stupid. So, Why wouldn't you do the same thing, for instance, with MS Marco? Like, even if you have a binary, you can sort of have some loose concept of like, you mark one passage, but you just mark how good of a result that is, or you know, like you try to find the best one, but you still say, okay, this is a, you know, like this is a two, this is a three, this is a one. Like, would that be like a bad idea, or why, or like?
I think it would be great if someone did it, but I think it's just very resource intensive to do. So, for example, deep learning, they're judging 50 queries like this. We saw in MS Marco, there's 7,000 queries in the development set. So just judging the development set using a procedure like this would take 100 times more work than what we normally do.
But no, but I mean, not judging densely, so like still doing it sparsely, but instead of doing it in a binary fashion, doing it in a graded fashion, like sparse graded annotations.
I see.
Is that something that...
I'm not sure. I haven't heard of that. I think one difficulty that I see is if you have sparse judgments, you probably want to use MRR. And if that's true, what you're going to do is you're going to take your top relevance grade, say that's a one, and then anything less relevant than your top, you know, your four, for example, so 0 through 3 mm-hmm. will be turned into a zero. Because otherwise you're going to, you either have to treat 4 and 3 the same or as one relevant, non-relevant. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess you could change metrics, but now you're headed in the direction of not really wanting sparse judgments because you're no longer using a metric that's well suited to this best document, right?
No, sure. It just, there's something that wraps me the wrong way to sort of give the same label to, even if you only surface the most relevant document, you know, like you can go on Google and search for a query where there's no good answer, right? Like even if you get the most relevant answer on the whole internet, that's still not relevant. And there's something that rubs me wrong saying, sort of giving the same label to that kind of thing than to like the query you said about net worth that has a very clear cut.
Yeah. I mean, this is true. So I think also training versus evaluation matters here. With training, I feel like you would really want the ones to know that this is somewhat relevant, but not the best. So in my head, I've created a new system. Two is now the best passage. One is something that's relevant, but not the best. Everything else, okay. I think that's kind of what you have in mind. And then zero is not relevant. So you could do that. So even following the procedure they propose here, you could create judgments like this. I'm just not sure what metric to then use to evaluate, because the procedure they've designed for collecting the judgments is targeted at this idea of a best passage. But for example, for training, I think that would be particularly useful, right? You can always have all these somewhat relevant documents that you know are more relevant than the not relevant. It's a lot more relevant labels, I guess, is what I'm trying to say for training. But this is done using the development set, so it is separate than the training data, I guess.
There's a lot of this nitty-gritty.
I think it just comes from the unusual situation. This, we want to find the absolute best answer.
So that's a given,
yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to this pooling that they proposed, right? Because I think we got off a tangent a bit here.
We were talking about how they propose updating judgments for MS Marco.
Yeah, exactly.
The idea is, they have basically a running best passage for every query. Whenever they have a new passage ranked top by a system that has not been compared to this best passage, I guess they compare it. And now they either replace the best passage or the best passage remains the best, which gives you essentially updates to the relevant judgment every time a new run comes in.
And this is done just in a continuous fashion, and I guess the leaderboard keeps getting
updated. Yeah, I think this is the idea. Okay. So
they provide some small experiments, right? After doing some re-labeling, right? Which is like a small experiment that sort of would be the same idea.
So they run like some version of this experiment using a subsample of the 7,000 queries. So they sample 500 queries, and I think they have 11 runs, I want to say. And for these 11 runs, they basically perform this experiment and come up with a new ranking or a new MRR for each of these runs based on trying to find the best passages. So for each query, they take a pool of candidate passages that might be the best.
Okay.
So, you know, here's query.
So when you say run, it means like a model.
This is jargon. This is a run is a ranking from a model. So a run would consist of different queries, and for each of those queries, ranking of documents. This is
but
shorthand.
Each run, so all of the runs are sharing queries?
Yeah.
Right?
So a run is like your results on the dev set.
Okay.
Think of it like
okay.
that.
Yeah. Okay.
This comes from like trek run file is a common way to talk about the output of these systems.
Okay.
Jargon from there.
Okay.
Yeah. So they take these runs, and so for each query, they create a pool of highly ranked documents for that query. There's a histogram of this somewhere, but for example, are, say, a little over 80 queries with pool size 2. There are about 100 queries with pool size 4. So that means for those 100 queries, they have 4 different documents mm-hmm. they've identified need to be judged.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. So you like recreate these sort of sets of documents to say, hey, one of these is highly relevant, so judge it for me, and then replace that label. Versus what used to be there.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So they want to find a new best passage, maybe new, maybe the QRL, but they want to identify the best passage given mm-hmm. the rankings returned by these.
Yeah, yeah.
Given those new best passages, they want to compute new rankings for these mm-hmm. different runs.
Okay, makes sense.
So they do that. They compute new rankings. So this is in, for example, figure 5. Also in, what is it, table 3. I think the figure is a bit easier to look at, though. If you look at the right side of figure 5, the x-axis is the official leaderboard order of the runs. So if nothing changes, you would expect things to continue to decrease on the x-axis.
I see.
Which is not the case.
Absolutely, yeah. So you would just imagine them ordered, and then you would see like a monotonically
decreasing. Yeah. Exactly. But what you see, for example, is run C looks like it's better than run A, for example, even including the 95% confidence interval. It's quite small, mm-hmm. but I think the endpoints are excluded. And, you know, so the third ranked run here looks to be a bit better than the first ranked run.
Yeah.
This is, of course, just changing judgments on those 500 queries. So I guess you can argue about the sample size and so on. But they do have some analysis with this.
But the sample size is critique that I've heard, I don't know if it was originally from Leo Boitsov, who wrote this short commentary on the...
Yeah, he has a short blog post on this, I think.
I don't know if it was from his, but the idea is that this, even if being a 500 subset of queries, that might be too small to draw strong conclusions, because apparently there might be some instabilities or some... like what.
Yeah, I guess the point is that, you know, you're going from 7,000 to 500 queries. So maybe 500 is enough, maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. Based on, I guess, the confidence intervals here, to me, it looks reasonable,
but I'm not
certain either.
Yeah, it looks, and like you said, in figure 4, there's, they do some comparisons between smaller...
Oh, right. So this is, this is figure 4, yeah. So here they're comparing against the actual MRR eval set, so those hidden judgments, but we know the metrics because MS Marcos, you know, revealed them. And then on the x-axis, it's their 500 query sample of the development set rather than the full development set.
Okay, so yeah.
So there's still a pretty good correlation between the small dev set and eval.
I don't see any like glaring outlier.
No, I mean they say here tau correlation equals 1, which is quite high as far as tau.
Like how many zeros are there after the comma? So they perform the experiments, and I guess like we can talk a bit more about this figure 5, right? Which is maybe the best sort of visualization of what happens when you re-annotate this. How I thought of this that I want to share is this is a bit like having training on having the same benchmark, right, from MS Marco, but doing the split, the train and test split sort of before the annotations, and then telling different people to annotate the training and the test set. Because I do feel like in that way you're gonna have some shift, right? Because the biases that people have annotating one thing and the other are gonna be different. And I feel like this is sort of a pretty similar scenario, right? Because the people who re-annotate these are different people who annotated the first one. So I'm guessing that the effects you see here should be comparable, I guess, if you did this kind of thing, or?
Yeah, I guess that effect would definitely be there, the difference in people. But I think also the instructions changed, which is a separate effect that also might matter, right? So now they're explicitly telling them to find the best passage.
Okay.
Originally, they didn't have this instruction at all, right? They were just trying to find the answer in any passage.
Absolutely, yeah. So now it's indeed quite a different annotation task. It's like find the best out of these 10 and really do it like comparatively.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So what would you say on this figure? Like, we cannot show it right now here. Maybe I can just add the, superimpose the picture.
Yeah, you should read the paper regardless, but that's a great reason to look at it. Yeah, so figure 5, there's 2 subplots on the left and the right. Both x-axes are different runs. And then on the y-axis, you have performance either on the official judgments or performance based on the new preference judgments that were, found by, identifying this best passage.
Yeah.
So on the left, looking at the leader, the official runs versus the official metric, what you find is that they're more or less monotonically decreasing, I think.
I think they're almost
close
perfect.
Exactly, maybe, but close. And you see that a lot of confidence intervals overlap.
Exactly. If you take into account the confidence intervals, you can get it monotonically decreasing.
Yeah. So, for example, I think the first 10 runs, I think their confidence intervals all have some overlap at least.
Mm-hmm.
On the right side, you have the same runs, but now they're ranked with relation to these new preference judgments, so the best passage judgments. Things are a bit more mixed up now. So you see, for example, the top run before, run A, is slightly below the third run, run C, and it actually even looks like their confidence intervals don't overlap. It's hard to see, but they barely overlap, if anything.
Yeah.
So it's no longer monotonically decreasing, I guess, is the point here. The best run, according to the left, the official metrics, is no longer the best, according
to the
right.
And I guess one of the interesting points to note here is that if you can clearly see this trend up to, you're going to talk about this, about up until model H, I think, right, where all of the documents seem to have really comparable performance, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you sort of split this second side of the plot, those other models do decrease really clearly monotonically, more or less.
Yeah, exactly. And that's because H, I think, is position 13, I is position 30, and they don't go down from I, right? So one is like 80, one is 115. So there's some positions between, say, 30 and 120.
So these second part are like really models that are really low in the ranking on the official MS Marco.
Exactly. So this figure, if you look at, say, the right half of figure 5, like I said, you see that the order of some methods seems to change. C definitely seems better than A. For example, F definitely seems better than D or E, for example, based on these confidence intervals. They're very small, but I think this is true. So there is some mix-up. But look at the left. So look at the confidence intervals on the left. They overlap quite a bit, right, on the official judgments. So in some sense, you wouldn't necessarily expect, say, method D to be better than F based on this, because their confidence intervals are so close. So it is drawing a different conclusion in a way if you only look at the point estimate, but not if I were to look at the intervals here.
Yeah. No, I get your point. I mean, what I wanted to ask you is, like, it does seem indeed that, for instance, in the right hand side, that things are mixed up a little bit, but there is still a pretty clear sort of downward direction of the models, right? Like, it's not monotonic, it does jump a bit, but it's not like it's not like the correlation is completely lost, right? It's not like,
no, not at all. One thing that's probably worth pointing out here is that these are not the top 12 or so models. The positions they come from change. So up until H, they come from the top 13 spots on the leaderboard. But now I is at position 30, K is at position 81, N is at position 93, P is at position 115.
That's true, but there's bigger gaps between these.
That's
a great point. I mean, then it would make sense, right? Because if you sort of think of this graph like a split into like the left hand side up to H and the right hand side, in the left hand side you really don't see any strong downward direction, right? Like you would say, like in the top 10 they're almost interchangeable. However, once you go to bigger differences, there is a correlation that survives these re-annotating.
Yeah,
right?
That's true. I mean, we definitely won't find that, say, P is the best method based on this, right? So yeah, this is absolutely.
Yeah. So what does this have to say? Is it something like MS Marco benchmark results are relevant, but only if the difference is above, you know, a certain decimal point, you know, like. When you look at the, MS Marco leaderboard, what sort of would capture your eye? As in, what kind of jump in performance you would say, okay, this is something, versus what kind of jump in performance is more like, yeah, just regular business, super over-optimizing on...
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and it's hard to put a number to. I guess I would... So one thing is this figure does not necessarily invalidate... The right side does not invalidate the left side because, you know, you do have all these overlapping intervals. I actually didn't check to see how they're calculated. I assume, you know, it's reasonable. And so it's not that it invalidates it. It just gives you a new picture of this, right? It's still compatible with the ranking on the left.
Yeah.
So I guess that's how I look at MS Marco personally. If you have a chunk of nearby methods, it's hard to separate them to me if what you care about is some other task or data set. If you really are just looking at the MS Marco eval set, then you can see they have different scores. But you know, these scores may not translate to any other setting. I don't know, right? Yeah. So you have one method is 2% better than the other one. Is that 2% going to hold in a radically different setting? Maybe, maybe not. It depends what they do. This is not a very satisfying answer, I feel like, though, right? I'm just saying, I don't know. You have to look at methods and
I understand. They're definitely super interesting. I would really try to. I mean, if you're listening to this only on audio, a bit sorry because we did really get a bit into the details of this particular figure, but I will try to just add this to the video version. So from this, I wanted to ask to take a step back again a bit. So I feel like we agree that this MS Marco type evaluation has, you know, like a lot of benefits. Well, mainly probably like the thing that it's really big and that it has a lot of annotations. It's the biggest one, I'm guessing. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a lot of problems on these benchmarks, like we've been discussing. So what are directions in the space of benchmarking information retrieval that you find exciting? What does, if you have to make a bet maybe in 5 years, how will we be evaluating retrieval models, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I think that this MS Marco strategy is probably here to stay, especially for training, maybe also for evaluation. But for training, it produces so many more queries. This seems to be a big advantage to have many queries. So I think that sparse paradigm for training, I would guess at this point, seems to be here to stay.
Yeah.
As far as evaluation, we're already seeing Trek Deep Learning as like a companion to MS Marco, right? So this is the 50 queries per year that are very densely judged.
Mm-hmm.
The impression I get is that people just trust this more. Like they treat it as more trustworthy because it's created within the standard assessment procedure as part of Trek, this retrieval conference that does this.
And this is something that happens yearly.
Yeah, yearly.
So like every year they like annotate a set of documents And then those are like blinded from people, and then people submit their models and they run them for them, and then you get a score out of that. Is that how it works?
Kind of. It's actually the reverse of that. So there are no annotations and everyone runs their models. Based on what the models find, they annotate some of the top documents. Okay. So the point being, these metrics are all really sensitive to the top, you know, rankings. Mm-hmm. So there's no point annotating, you know, position 1000 for everyone. That's okay, not going to change the metric at all, right? So they do some pooling to combine the top documents. Okay. And how they do this can become complicated, right? Maybe they're trying to estimate how good a run is, so that they pull in more documents from this system than from another system. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily all equal. But this is essentially it. They combine outputs from different systems and then they judge whatever they can from that output.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And what do you think about these other trends in benchmarking that... I mean, in a sense, this benchmarking on track is a bit benchmarking out... Well, not out of domain, but with the re-annotated data, right? Which is a bit close to what they do here. But I feel like there's been quite a lot of works that do this of benchmarking basically on a data set that is quite different from the training data set, right? What are interesting works in that space? Like, what do you think about this trend of like, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. So in IR, it's a very common situation to be doing this, maybe not a different document collection, but different queries are always what we've evaluated, right? So going back to this deep learning, you change the queries at eval time, right? You have some queries for training. They're always different at eval time. This is true for Trek. It's true for MS Marco. What we're also starting to do, I guess, because of deep learning is... there's now some issue with training a lot on a data set and transferring it, which I think is where you're going. So with MS Marco, it seems to be the case that you can train on this data set and the model will perform well on other data sets very often. This depends on the type of model. It seems to work better for cross-encoders as far as I've seen. So these re-ranking methods, it works better for.
Yeah.
This dense retrieval is harder.
In comparison to dense retrieval.
Right, right. Okay. But it does seem to be a viable strategy. You know, train your re-ranking method on MS Marco, then you can apply it to like a news data set, for example, with little problem. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that everything is totally different. Your queries are now keywords rather than natural language questions. Your documents are maybe news articles that are long rather than, you know, single succinct web passages. So it's quite different, but... It still works
quite well.
And so this is, I think, a trend. BIR or BIR, for example, is an IR data set that kind of does this. The idea is train on MS Marco and then see how well your model does everywhere else. This is sometimes called zero shot. Meaning you haven't trained on your target domain at all. You're now testing the model on this new domain. So BIR is, I think, an interesting new benchmark.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how it's pretty recent, right? So we'll see how much that gets picked up.
Yeah.
So another interesting sort of trend or direction that I think is happening, some other people mentioned this, is this idea of sort of opening the black box of evaluation and sort of trying to look at specific examples, looking at the... because the thing is that you can have two models that perform same on the aggregate, like on this, you know, MRR metric or whatever, and have completely different failure modes or sort of have very different qualitative behavior. So that is very interesting to look into. So what are your thoughts on like that kind of research or like what kind of thing can you take from that?
Yeah, so I think these qualitative evaluations are very interesting. But they're more, I feel like, for exploring in order to understand what's happening so that you could maybe improve things, right? Qualitatively, you can't, you know, look at these 7,000 queries. But I think this is very interesting. Some difficulties with it is you kind of have to hypothesize what behaviors your model could have, right? Mm-hmm. So if you compare two random passages, it's unclear. You have to have an idea of what your model may be doing, I think, in order to tell that it's failing here for this specific reason, which is difficult, but maybe not at all impossible.
Is there any effort that you know in that goes in the direction? So the problem with qualitative evaluation, like you said, it's really good for exploring, right? If you're doing research yourself, you should really probably look at the queries and specific examples and all of this kind of stuff. Pretty fundamentally, it's hard to compare qualitative, almost by definition, right? Qualitative observations, you cannot compare them easily or objectively, at least. So are there works that try to, quantify this or have some sort of different approach to?
Yeah, so this is a good point. So there's a few lines of work that basically hypothesize types of behavior that would be interesting to test for and then try to test for them. This isn't exactly looking at it qualitatively, but it's kind of going the reverse direction. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine qualitatively saying, oh, well, look, I think my model doesn't perform well when the English grammar is not very good, right? So maybe something was poorly written. Maybe my model is performing well for that reason. So, for example, there's a data set, Abnormal, by Sean McAvaney and co-authors, where they have basically tests for this. So they have like normal proofread version of some document and then a messier version of some document. I don't remember exactly where they get it.
A messier version of the document?
Yeah, messier in the sense that maybe the grammar is wrong or punctuation is wrong. Hasn't had some round of proofreading. I don't remember where they pull this from, but I think to think of it that this is a good explanation. Mm-hmm. So when you see a behavior like that, you could test it in this way. And that gives you a way to objectively test for whether this behavior matters. But you've got to find the behavior in the first place through some sort of qualitative evaluation.
Well, I mean, what I was thinking, I don't know if there's works on this precisely, is this idea of finding adversarial queries or like queries where your models perform really bad. And you can probably quantify that pretty well, right? And you can even use gradient descent to find, well, in natural language, it's probably a bit hard, but are you aware of works that do that kind of thing?
I don't think so, at least not offhand. I mean, this is a very reasonable thing to do, right? Find some, basically look at the queries where your model's performing the worst, try to figure out why. And I think this would lead you to some observation like I mentioned. Maybe, this could be better written. Maybe it's all lowercase and for some reason this messes things up. I don't know, right? You can, it's hard to come up with behaviors, but you could imagine, something like that.
Yeah.
I guess you could also say that these queries are the interesting ones. So there's a paper, MS Marco Chameleons, I think, where they try to find queries that are just really hard across a variety of models and then say these are interesting queries to look at specifically. But again, I'm getting away from the qualitative nature, right? I think it's hard other than coming up with something to test for or to inform how to change your model. I'm not sure how to do it qualitatively, I guess.
I understand. I mean, scientists like numbers, right? So if you can't detach a number to it, it's hard to grab a hold of it.
Yeah, I think the qualitative stuff is great, but you will need to do something quantitative to have some objective measurement at the end of the day, I guess.
No, absolutely. Yeah, so the other, in a related thing, I haven't heard any works that do this kind of thing that I think it would be really interesting. So one of the problems that we found working on this dense retrieval evaluation, I hope that I'm not revealing anything that is unstable, is this idea of not looking at failures for queries, but looking at failures for documents in the sense that when you have an index that is not static, you might have a model that performs really well and then introduce a set of documents that is quite different. Right, like completely different, like it's like really long, a different style of like of English, or it has a lot of noise in the data, like you have a lot of, you parse tables in a weird way, whatever. Right, in a keyword-based retrieval setting, you have like pretty strong guarantees that that's not going to show up on top because of how the things are calculated. But what we find is that often you encode things in a model that performs really well, and suddenly there's some garbage that constantly keeps popping up, and then suddenly a model that was really good suddenly is bad because the index changed.
Huh.
I don't know. Are there like works that look at these sort of, I guess you could say it's like adversarial documents kind of thing, like finding documents that are relevant for all queries in a wrong way?
So, this goes back, I think, to an old problem of just spam and web search. So with previous methods, there would be a lot of query repetitions, but I mean, they would try to include query terms in a spammy document to somehow make the spammy document appear.
Okay.
Right? So.
Okay, yeah.
There's work that adversarial side of things. More recently, I'm not I think I've seen some, but I'm not aware of it offhand,
No, but that's a great point. Like, I can see, like, an evil agent, like, really... Yeah.
But here, I don't think it's a spammy document, I would guess, because data sets, for example, you know, literature, scientific literature, I don't think it's a spam. But it's something like that. Like, for some spurious reason, it's...
Yeah, exactly. It's spurious. Yeah. It's not really, like, any intentional, you know, thing. But it just, like, I'm guessing, like, these embedding spaces can be very... I mean, okay, this only applies for the dense retrieval case, but if you do nearest neighbor, normally these spaces are quite degenerate, right? In the sense that, like, documents are not sort of distributed all around the space, and you have, like, some sort of probably, like, region in this hyperdimensional space where your documents are, and a region where your queries tend to be, and that might not align perfectly. And then if you have, new documents that sort of happen to be encoded very close to the sort of region where queries tend to be encoded, for some spurious reason, you might get, you know, like, this document that is close to all the queries. Or I don't know. I'm really speculating here. Like, it just...
But it's true. I mean, it's some failure of the embedding space. Basically, these two things have a dot product that's high, and they shouldn't have a dot product that's high.
Yeah.
It's right. Exactly. There's some issue with how they're embedded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is, we really hope that there's more, the research community also improves in this space, because it also helps a lot, I think, on the industry side, where we have a bit more more experience, right, with all of these problems about robustness and in the index, the different document types, index, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, data sets like this are really helpful for studying those kind of problems in the academic setting, right? Mm-hmm. Because now we can train on MS Marco, there's a lot of it, try to apply it to other data sets, which is somewhat analogous, I think, to what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I don't know. It as a closing remark, is MS Marco sort of... Would you say MS Marco is gonna fade a bit in popularity?
Well, or yes, but this is cheating, and it's because there's an MS Marco V2. So separate from that, I don't think this it will make it fade in popularity.
Actually, I don't know about that. How different is it? Or what?
So I'm actually not very familiar with it. I know that they increased the size of the document collection quite a bit, but we've been talking about the passage collection the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
The document collection is just taking those passages and expanding to include the document they were found in, essentially. Yeah. But I actually don't know offhand any large changes here.
Yeah.
I think how they segmented passages was changed, for example, but I'm not very familiar with all the specifics.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's very new.
So I think we've been talking for about an hour or something like that. Do you have any, other remark or things that you would like to bring up before we...
No, I think it was a great discussion. It's, a very interesting paper, I'll say again.
I absolutely agree. And I think, like, it's really good to, to sort of wonder about all of these information retrieval evaluation big questions that are, like, have so many ramifications, like you said. I mean, it's so easy to get lost in the... I don't know. I hope that we can get to talk about these kind of things a bit more in the future, maybe from different angles or from different papers, different people, maybe. But this was great.
Yeah, it was great.
So thank
you for inviting me.
I guess I'll see you in the next one.
Yeah, see you then.